just one more thing. Am I speaking? This was Leonard.
Leonard Stringfield, yes.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, Leonard. Now, there's something that sort of bothers me, though. Now, evidently, these people, what, they have to travel over a large distance to reach us. Is this correct now, or is this the assumption that these people are coming from a...
Yes, from a these crashes occur in random areas, often requiring distance for the troops or whatever to get in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now, what concerns me is that if these people, and we have to, I think we almost have to assume that they have... reached a technological level to where they can travel these vast distances. Now, it seems to me that, you know, that by now, if, say, the first few did crash or something happened, they weren't familiar with our particular conditions here on this planet.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that somehow they would have got communication back to their kinsmen or something.
Yes.
And these crashes wouldn't keep occurring. Now, this bothers me. Now, I'm not trying to put any any holes in your research. Believe me, because I'm somewhat of a scholar, and I went pretty heavy into math and so forth. But this does bother me. And do you have any kind of an explanation for that?
Is your question now concerning
My question is this, that it seems to me that if they possess the technology to, travel these vast distances to reach us here, that they certainly would have navigation equipment that is far superior, probably, to anything that we know right now. And it seems to me that these crashes, certainly could be avoided, especially if their craft is equipped with, some type of gravitation devices or something.
Yes, well, I have considered that, too. And I think that anything... like anywhere, whether it's from this galaxy or another galaxy or wherever, and no matter how sophisticated it may be, everything is subject to error.
This is true.
To making a mistake, and I think that I think that would include any extraterrestrial.
Mm-hmm.
They're all subject to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
If the machine is cybernetically controlled,
yes,
computers are subject to making errors. I know as ours do.
Yes,
and
true.
I have every reason to believe that anyone out there would be subject to mistakes. They may make less of them.
Well, I think we can get.
I would like to add this now. Since World War II, has been many, many years have passed, and we only have. Perhaps 12 to perhaps 24 crashes in all those years with these numerous flights that have been reported.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually a small number.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of crashes are seemingly small or rare considering the overall surveillance.
Mr. Stringfield?
Yes.
This is David on the line.
Maybe as opposed to human error, maybe we can coin a new term and call that humanoid error.
Yes.
Well, gentlemen, if I can jump in there for Mel and the rest of them, I think we have Wendell Stevens on the line. Wendell, are you there? Hello, Wendell.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Bill?
Mel was wondering why the crashes are there. These are very advanced in their technology. What's going wrong? And it seems like we have discussed that before, that maybe radar or something was one of
them. Well, there's another thought here, too. Yes, I've heard that radar, electrical storms, atmospheric conditions, computer error, but there's one other thought. This information has been coming to me here from various sources, and again, it's hypothetical, but magnetic grid network encompassing the Earth's sphere, and this may account for the UFO's flight pattern, east to west, north to south, and so forth, and in some rare instances cause abortive behavior or the crashes. Now, this is a magnetic grid system which is encompassing the Earth's sphere. Now, I won't go into that because that requires a lot of technical explanation that's beyond my knowledge, but this seems to account for some of the error in their flight behavior.
Do you have anything to add to that, Wendell, before we go on?
Well, the one case that I was working with over in South Carolina, Bill Herman, I believe you had him on the program one time.
Yes, I did. Tried to get him on tonight, but he wasn't answering.
Oh, yeah. Where the alien entities mentioned to him that one of their craft was damaged by a certain kind of radar that was used in... It was nose... lock-on radar used on fighter aircraft several years ago that they lost, or they had a ship go out of control because they calculated later, because the radar locked on it and it stayed on long enough to upset the autopilot system or the computer system that ran the craft. And that caused them some problems.
So there's always error there, Mel. It can happen to everybody, and including our friends from space.
Okay.
All right, Mel. Thank you very much.
You bet.
You're on the Open Mind program. I'm Bill Jenkins. Our subject tonight is crashed UFOs in the United States and the retrieval process that goes on. My guest, foremost investigators of the UFO phenomena, and we have a young man also on the line who has decided to stay with us, and we're glad he has, who was involved in guarding one of these crashed UFOs, an eyewitness to the incident. So let's get on back to it and to our callers. KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins in the Open Mind program.
Hello, this is Louis.
Hello, Louis.
See, I was just wondering, your description a few minutes ago of what you saw kind of meshes with something that I saw on a very special maneuver that was conducted at Camp Ripley, Minnesota in 64, about June. We were, I was with the National Guard out there in Wichita, Kansas, and they, I think it was the 32nd Division was what they called it out there. They took us all up to Camp Ripley in a great big convoy. And one moonless night out there, they had us dig in, and we were told to stay in place, that they were going to attempt to attack us. Some special assault groups were. And they were very weird, I thought, very unusual the way they gave us instructions. They told us under no circumstances were we to move. They gave us a lot of instruction in the use of visual purple and night vision training by looking out of the corner of our eyes. And they told us to notify our immediate superior even if we went to the pit latrine that they had dug out there. And after a few hours of darkness, a little after midnight, I got kind of tired of just sitting in one place. And I went back to the latrine, and then I don't know, I guess I was kind of bored. I took my rifle and I went for about 25 or 30 feet. And I thought I heard something. And so I just stuck down where I was. I didn't want to get in any trouble since they'd given us such harsh instructions about moving. My legs had been kind of cramped earlier, and I wanted to stretch out for just a few paces and then go back to my foxhole there. But when I ducked down beside these bushes, I noticed a guy was walking very close to me that had a different kind of a uniform than I did. He had a different kind of a helmet. He had something he was holding in his hand that looked like, it was a sighting device of some type where he was able to see through the darkness better than I was. And so I followed this guy for a little while. His weapon looked different than mine. It didn't look like a submachine gun would have looked, and it was smaller. And I thought, Jesus, this is kind of an unusual guy. If he's the aggressor, there's no use my just letting him go on, towards our communications gear. So I followed him for a little while, and I think a couple of times he was pretty well on to the fact that I was following him, but being an old country boy, he just didn't quite nail me down. Every time he turned around and looked at me, I managed to duck down and keep myself between shrubbery and him. But I followed him, I'd say for a good 300 meters, and then I noticed that his footprints, which evidently I could see a little bit in the light. There was no moon, and his footprint just kind of ended at, I would say, a tree that was about 35 feet high. And when his prints ended, I thought, oh no, I really blew it now. This guy's probably sitting right on top of me in the tree. But before I started to look up at the tree, I noticed that the air was warmer. And I noticed there was some kind of a gentle downdraft. And when I started to look up, I noticed something else that startled me almost immediately, where there had been no clouds before, and we at least had the starlight. All of a sudden, I realized that there was no starlight over me. The stars were blocked out by some sort of a rather large object. And so I moved my eyes around rather quickly, you know, to see if I could frame this thing. It was obviously a black object. And when I checked around the top of me, I noticed that it was circular. And doggone if I didn't hear a metal door slide away. And I looked up. There was a square door in the center of this thing, and I could hear sort of an electronic whining sound, one like you'd hear with possibly with hydraulic equipment running, but I'm only guessing.
Lou, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
This is David. This was in Kansas now?
Well,
in Wichita. Can you remember the year?
I was in that National Guard unit
what
out
year?
There that they have on, it's the one... south of town there. We were in the old 32nd Division, and they moved us in a big convoy.
What town was it in, or what area, what state?
Well, they moved us up to Camp Ripley, Minnesota for this maneuver.
So this happened in Minnesota?
Yeah, this happened on a moonless night there after they had given us a bunch of training in night vision.
What year?
It was 64, I believe, June, or I believe it was about June of 64. And this object that I looked up and saw bore a very strong resemblance to the one that he said he was guarding. And that's why it kind of shocked me when I sat here and was listening to what he said. Also, the way that I noticed the warm air near it, and when I was under it, sort of a downward, very, very gentle warm air current. The only thing is that I don't know whether he was under it or not. I would say that I probably saw the same vehicle, but I was under it, and it was painted black, or was black. And but the thing about it was is this square door under on the bottom side of it slid away, and then I could hear the sort of an electronic equipment sound whine. There was no motor noise at any time.
Did you see it fly away, or was that just it? It was above you.
Well, no, I fell backwards then. I was so startled by the whole thing, I fell backwards on the ground, and I was laying there with my rifle looking up at this thing. And the square door, they had red blackout lights in it. I could hear a couple of voices talking, but I couldn't really make out that much what they were saying. I would estimate that they were somewhere around, probably 38 feet or 40 feet above me. And it was a big object. I mean, it was not a...
What size was this being that you saw?
This
is Len Stringfield.
The man appeared to me to be a soldier with special equipment, the likes of which I'd never seen before. The only thing is that years later, I saw a Mechanics Illustrated story on the Servo Soldier and also the old-style radio helmet, the one that was shaped differently with the antenna in the top. Okay. And when I saw those pictures of some of their experimental gear that they had in that regard, and the later on when they made it plain that they had the night vision scope, it was obvious to me then that this is what the guy was carrying. But now, let me tell you what happened. I really felt like at this point I was in over my head, and I'd already violated orders by walking away from where they had me stationed. So I got the hell out of there and got back to where I was supposed to be. But the next morning, they had my whole unit up. They had us standing at attention in the sun for somewhere a little over 3 hours. They were screaming at us, wanting to know who it was that left their post, who it was that had followed this guy. They reminded us that there was classified... operations taking place. We were told not to leave our post. And I don't know, the way they handled it and the way they asked their questions, it was so frightening that for 4 years I wouldn't even talk to my best buddies in the National Guard unit. I wouldn't even admit I had done it. But they narrowed it down to where they were sure that it was one of three of us that had followed this guy. He just looked like an average height being to me. I'm 6 foot. He seemed a little smaller, but he didn't seem small enough for me to notice. I was certain beyond a shadow of a doubt later on when Well, you know, I was looking for ways to explain it. You know, I guess everyone tries to justify what they see. Later on, I read an article about some of their secret work in quietcopters that there's been a little bit of talk about, and I thought, well, if it was a quietcopter, I could understand it, but there just wasn't any engine noise other than just a faint whine of maybe hydraulic or sound like generating gear.
I'll interrupt you just a second here. I know you don't have the time to go into a full explanation, and nor would I have time to ask a lot of questions now, but would it be possible if you could send me a report on this to my home address and your phone number, and I could be in touch with you?
I tell you, well, we have all of the information on Louis here for you, okay?
Okay.
Leonard, and I'll send it on to you.
All right. I would like to be able to be in touch with this gentleman and discuss it further. I have some questions which I wouldn't want to put over the air.
But anyway, I wanted to say one thing to you before we cut it off. It's been my firm opinion since this incident happened that, and since I saw the later on articles about this experimental military gear that was not adopted in the way of the helmet and all, and which is actually what I saw that night, this guy wearing, I have felt like that this was in the inventory, and I had felt like it was on the order of a quietcopter. But there's other things about it that just didn't quite add up. It's been a long time ago. I don't remember all the details now, I'm sure, as well as I did then, but let me tell you, the last remark that was made to me by somebody who was identified as a United States Army intelligence officer, when they had me in for... He said, "You are the one that followed that guy, aren't you?" He said, "You are the one that was over there out of position." He said, "I feel like it's you, but," he said, "we really can't prove whether it's you or one of these other two guys, but," he said, "personally, I believe it is you."
Lou, is that your name?
Lou, yes.
Yeah. Lou and Mr. Stringfield?
Yeah.
Isn't it true, back a number of years ago, Donald E. Kehoe was saying that all the major corporations, Northrop, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Lockheed, and many other military-based companies had tremendous contracts, if I recall, from the government on anti-gravity devices. Isn't that true?
Yes, they were all working at it, but we had been unable to learn how successful.
I was kind of interested in listening to Louis.
And that goes back many, many back in the 50s. But again, whatever they've come up with, of course, will remain top secret. And
can I make a remark that might
be... There's no question that we have been trying to develop a replica of this, you know, of the prototype, the original, the extraterrestrial device.
I tell you what, time's getting away from us here just a little bit.
All right.
Lurie, I'm going to pass your telephone number and things along to Mr. Stringfield, and he can talk to you more, you know, off the air about this. Would that be all right?
Yeah, can I make one last quick remark to you there?
Yeah,
I worked over at Pacific Air Motive at the Hollywood Burbank Air Terminal, and a number of times there I saw vertical takeoff planes leave, and they always kind of did it on a moonless night, you know, when it was dark. Sometimes the only thing you'd see would just be one nav light on. But one night there, I noticed on one of their vertical takeoff planes, when I was in my car at the parking lot at Pacific Air Motive, I noticed leaving from one of the Lockheed buildings, one of their vertical takeoff planes took off almost without noise, very similar to the sound that this thing made. And it didn't get very high at all until it was just almost inaudible. And I really kind of suspect that this is something that they had a few prototypes in the inventory of. I really believe that this guy that saw this thing on guard probably saw about the same thing I did, and I do believe when they told him it was something in the inventory, I think it was. Especially now that I've heard somebody else see something like I did. It's been many years, and all I've ever been is laughed at for the story and kidded about the super soldier, and I really believe now that you are talking about something that was in the inventory at one time.
That's a very interesting point, and we appreciate that much, Lily. And Leonard will get in touch with you and go into further detail with a little later, okay?
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for calling. KABC Times, 22 minutes of midnight. One of those crash UFOs, he thinks. However, Louis just said it may not have been that who talked to him a minute ago. Let's go to another caller. KABC, you're on Open Mind with Bill Jenkins.
Hello. My name is Chuck.
Chuck?
And I'm a member of a group called the 311 Group. It's a newly formed group. It's a private group.
that is doing investigation on extraterrestrials and UFO landings, too. And I've been listening to your show tonight, and we're talking about all the UFOs that have crashed. And a question that comes up in our conversation is, if all these UFOs are crashing, and we have records of all of them, well, the big question is, how many of the UFOs have actually landed? I listened to the show a couple of weeks ago, and we had some people talking about the Pleiades people, people that were already here among us.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I was just wondering if this man from the Blue Beret, if he has any documentations of actual landings, not just the crashes, but landings and the extraterrestrials getting out.
Did we touch on that a minute ago, Leonard, about the incident at Nellis Air Force Base?
I didn't hear that.
Well, this was Chuck calling, and he is involved in these things, and he wanted to know if you had any incidents or any...
Of landings?
Of landings, yeah.
Oh, yes. These are too numerous to mention. We have those by the thousands. That is going all the way back to World War II. These are getting they're getting about as common as in close encounters of the third kind. And we now have 2,000 reports, mind you, logged. On close encounters of the third kind. That's the encounter with the entities and landed craft.
I think, Wendell, you could add something to that there, couldn't you?
I'm sure that Wendell can.
An interesting thing. Since the book got distributed and got around a little bit, a lot more people have contacted us to tell us about their personal experiences. And the thing that's most baffling is the amount of contact that's going on that is unreported. Since the last time I talked to you, Bill, I've picked up 4 new cases that involve extensive contact that is kept pretty much quiet in a local group of people, usually a family or very close friends. One lady has written down over 200,000 words of notes on the contacts and the experiences. Now, that's a lot of notes. That's over 1,000 type pages of notes.
Where are these people from?
I don't remember where she said they came from. She's working directly with Dr. Leo Sprinkle at the moment, though, and she's joining him here in about a week for some more hypnotic regression to try to find out how and when a device was implanted in her head, which they used to contact her and maintain a regular communication.
Does that help answer your question, Chuck?
It does, but in a crash situation, we have actual pieces of metal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for concrete evidence of actual landing. They're like burn marks on the ground, maybe...
Those are all over.
They're all over.
They're everywhere.
Well,
worldwide.
Okay, well, with the report
on the
news, we'll be doing our research too then.
Yeah, so. if you have a chance to pick up a book, called UFO Reports from Flying Saucer Review. It's possibly maybe out of print, but probably available at your library, and there are thousands and thousands of cases there of landings, as well as Mr. Springfield's book, Situation Red, the UFO Siege.
Also, Chuck, I might tell you that I'm trying to get a gentleman on the show in a couple of weeks, if I can run him down, who's going to talk about the different structures that are on the moon right now. And that's quite fascinating, too.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
KABC time is 15 minutes of midnight. Listen, young David, who is guarding one of those crashed UFOs, is also on board, and we're ready to take more of your questions. KABC, you're on with Bill Jenkins.
Hi, this is Homer.
Hello, Homer.
Have you ever taken any of this blank solid material and put it on a mass spectrograph or put in an X-ray analysis machine to determine the structure?
You're not coming in clear there, Homer. What was the question again?
Have you ever taken any of this flying saucer material and put it on a mass spectrograph to determine its elements, or put it on an X-ray diffraction machine to determine its molecular structure?
Okay. Has testing been done of material from the crash disk, I think is Homer's main question there, Leonard.
I couldn't hear the question.
Well, he wanted to know if you have any of the results of any of the testing that's been done on the material that was found in the...
That is one area. When you get into the technical area of the crashed craft, that's a pretty sensitive area. It is easier, from my experience, getting information about the internal anatomy on the bodies than it is getting technical information concerning the craft.
this is one area that is really super sensitive. And as far as the getting any, if they, you know, any clear information, precise information concerning the propulsion system or the metals or anti-gravity or the cybernetics or whatever, that is most difficult. These people are under the tightest degree of secrecy, and there's no way that they will reveal anything without the, you know, having some kind of punitive action taken. So this is one area, too, that I'm very careful of. With the information that I have, in certain informants, why I've been told to be very, very careful with it, and that I could get in trouble myself. So I have to be very careful how they answer that.
Would you say something about the occupants, then?
Yeah, we discussed those a little earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, that's, they're little people, generally, about 4 or 4.5 feet tall, and humanoid in shape, primarily. Although they don't look exactly like us, the ones that have been retrieved so far as we can tell. Is that about correct, Leonard?
I was wondering about their body chemistry, principally.
Excuse me, Homer?
I was wondering about their body chemistry. Anything on that?
Maybe you can touch on that quickly again, Leonard, and we got to run.
On the body?
Yeah, the body chemistry.
They're about average 4 feet tall. They weigh around 40 pounds. The head is very large. If you could do what a five month human fetus would look like by going to any of your museums, or you might check on that. But it's four fingers, no thumb, webbing effect between each finger. The skin is not green, it's grayish color. There's no hair on the head or body. There's no GI tract. The mouth, there's only a slit that leads to nowhere. There's no digestive tract. There is a liquid in the body, which is not, does not have red cells, no lymphocytes. And there's much more. But the best way to get all the information, is I have quite a bit, is to order the paper itself, Fetus Report Number 2, which would cost $5, by mailing it to the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, at 103 Old Town Road, that's one word, Old Town, in Seguin, Texas, S-E-G-U-I-N, zip code 78155. Now, in there, I have several pages of anatomical description of the body, external, internal, and also drawings.
Okay, Homer? Listen, we really were cramped for time here, Homer, and I'm going to have to run on that one, and we'll get right back to our questions in just a moment.
Hey, this is...
...meeting us tonight, and we're going to have to do it again because we just touched the tip of the iceberg.
We didn't scratch the surface, really. There's so much to relate, and I'm the first one to admit it is a very incredible story, and I feel very privileged to have the information that I have, and I hope that I'm using it correctly. I do believe the public should have this information. I think that's a must, and I'll do everything I can to impart information.
And if anybody does feel like they want to talk to you later, they can contact me.
I want you to give my address over the phone, if it's permissible or advisable. If anyone wishes to impart information on a very confidential basis, I'd be willing to relate to them on that basis. And I am reachable at... 4412 Grove Avenue, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45227. To be very frank, I'm not interested in researching lights in the sky anymore. There's nothing, no way we can resolve those. It's like beating a dead horse. But I am concerned. I narrowed down my research to UFO crash retrievals. And anyone that wishes to impart information on a confidential basis, I'll be delighted to receive it and to exchange information with you.
Bill, could I ask Mr. Stevens a quick question?
We've got to make it real quick, David.
Mr. Stevens, you're noted for a very famous photograph that was taken in Canada, and I'd just like briefly to, maybe you can elate what went through your mind when you saw this.
Which photograph are you talking about, sir?
The one that was taken in Canada.
Near Calgary, Canada?
Yes, sir.
At Highwood Ranger Station?
Yes, sir.
I'm very impressed with the photographs. Those have never been disputed. They've been checked by computers, and they stand the testing. They seem to be legitimate photographs.
Hey, listen, I'm going to let you two talk off the air, if you don't mind, because our time has just run out. Wendell, I'm so happy that you joined us. David, you too. We'll see you next week on KABC's Open Mind.
Hey.